This is your Sunday morning wake-up call on WNRN. The wake-up call is supported by Tiger Fuel, homegrown since 1982. You can visit Charlottesville's only locally owned and operated chain of convenience stores today. They operate on Main Street, not Wall Street. Now your host, Rick Moore.
Hey, good morning, everybody here at WNRN. I'm Rick Moore. Thanks for listening. And thanks to the Richmond folks at 103.1. I'm laughing because Rusty Simpre is running around accusing people of stealing his pen or his pencil, which takes us perfectly to our topic today of incarceration. And because Rusty can be a little self-serving and nervous about his writing utensils, he's very particular. Our guest today, Brenda Castaneda, here from the Legal Aid Justice Center, and her co-worker, Mary Bauer. Good morning, ladies.
Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having us.
And thanks to the two of you for being here. It is a beautiful Sunday morning. I'm always thankful to folks who give up their hour or two to come in and participate in the conversation. Incarceration. We're going to be talking about a variety of pieces that go into that, from solitary confinement. Virginia has some a new program that goes along with that, elderly inmates, reform, and we're going to start off with a case that caught my interest and sort of put this topic on my landscape as I go to schedule things. Healthcare and a specific case that's taking place down in Fluvanna Correctional Center for Women. So I want to jump right into that. There is a Fluvanna Correctional Center for Women. There is a case involving healthcare, and Brenda Castaneda, you are the lead on that, correct?
I wouldn't say I'm the lead. We are partnering with a firm out of D.C. called Wiley Ryan, and there's a lawyer there, Ted Howard, who's the lead lawyer on the case. But I've been working on it for a number of years, and we're all working pretty closely together.
Tell us a bit about what's happened.
Well, we started getting a lot of complaints in through our Institutionalized Persons Project about the healthcare at Fluvanna a number of years ago now, and we began investigating the problem and going out there to meet with clients, to meet with the prisoners there, and talked about the problems they were having, getting even sort of basic healthcare needs met. And decided that it was serious enough that we ought to do something about it. And so we worked on the case for a long time and investigated, worked with a lot of different prisoners, and eventually filed a lawsuit.
When you say that there were, I don't remember the word that you specifically used, but when you talked about important health care needs not being met, what are we talking about here? People not getting their aspirin?
It's more serious than that. There's a lot of people with serious healthcare problems there, and they're not getting basic treatment. So it can be anything from somebody with diabetes just not having their blood sugar monitored well, to somebody with cancer who starts having symptoms and then doesn't get treated for a long time. There's one client we have who had an abnormal mammogram and didn't get any follow-up for a whole year, at which point she was had pretty advanced breast cancer. So it's that sort of thing, just serious problems and the treatment not being forthcoming or not being forthcoming in a timely way.
I'm sure that there are some people listening, or at least one person listening, who wants to know why this is important. Why should I care about this? Someone has committed a crime important enough to go to prison, and they're not getting the health care that goes with that? Why is that important to me?
Well, I mean, there are a couple answers to that. One is that the overwhelming majority of people who are incarcerated are going to get out. And so it's important that the treatment that they receive be appropriate while they're there, and that they not be made significantly worse off by having been in prison. But second, on a moral level, once the state takes custody of people, they have an obligation to make sure that they're not going to actually affirmatively hurt or kill people. Both constitutionally and on a moral level, we have that obligation. Beyond that, we're spending an enormous amount of money in our society to incarcerate huge numbers of people, and we can all be concerned about whether that's a good use of our money long term.
All right. Again, this is WNRN Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call. our guest today, Brenda Castaneda, and that was Mary Bauer, both from Charlottesville's Legal Aid and Justice Center. Brenda, so we talk about this particular case, and you've mentioned a few specific incidents, and I don't have the names written down, but there was one woman who complained of abdominal pains who... eventually, almost a year went by before finally sent to UVA, where it was determined that she had a stage 4 cancer.
Yes, that's one of the things that happened that I believe we alleged in our lawsuit. There's been a number of deaths that have occurred at Fluvanna. And to some extent, you have an aging population. There's people in ill health, and that's to be expected in a large group of people. But we believe that a number of the deaths were preventable with appropriate care, and that it's part of the problem is that these women aren't getting care, that this woman had problems for a year that weren't addressed, and that eventually when she was sent to UVA, they found out that her cancer was very advanced, and she died shortly thereafter. There was another incident, I believe, with a woman who was diabetic, and a number of our clients actually witnessed her die, and it was quite traumatic for them. She had gone into shock, and the medical staff, by the time they tried to revive her, were not able to. And that is a problem that we see with a lot of the women there with the diabetes and the monitoring. I have a lot of clients who have problems with that, have extremely irregular blood sugar, and are not getting monitored in an appropriate way.
Well, one of your coworkers at the Legal Aid Justice Center said that there were over 10 deaths that could have been prevented with adequate medical care. But there's someone from the Department of Corrections says that many inmates enter prison with these conditions that have already been neglected. So my follow-up to that is, what are the needs, what are the responsibilities of the state to provide medical care?
Well, the state has a duty under the U.S. Constitution to provide adequate medical care once it's taken somebody into custody and they're no longer out free in society. So whatever conditions they come in with, they should be screened for, and if they need follow-up care, they should receive appropriate care at that time.
And Rick, can I follow up with that? You know, one of the things we see at Fluvanna is very typical of prisons throughout the country, and that is that the state here has contracted with private for-profit companies to provide health care. And that is just increasingly common, that either there's a contract for medical care that's with a private for-profit company, or in many instances, the entire prison is a for-profit endeavor. And in our view, that's very problematic, because the incentive there is to provide then as little care as possible. The cheapest thing to do is obviously to let people die. And we're not saying that that happens, you know, consistently and deliberately, that, you know, people are simply permitted to die. But that is clearly, you know, what a for-profit entity has an incentive to do. And that's the wrong incentive.
Again, our guests today, Brenda Castaneda, Mary Bauer, both from Charlottesville's Legal Aid Justice Center. We're talking about incarceration, starting off with some specific lawsuit going on against the Fluvanna Correctional Center for Women and Virginia's Department of Corrections. And that's a big issue that we're going to get into later in the hour, is the for-profit version of what's happening with health care in the Virginia prisons. And it's not just Virginia prisons, it's nationally. But, Brenda, you mentioned the responsibility of the state being to take care of inmates. You said it's a constitutional issue. Where? Because for many people, the Constitution is life, liberty, pursuit of happiness, or food, shelter, and clothing. I don't see health care anywhere in there.
Well, our lawsuit is alleging that it's a violation of the right to be free of cruel and unusual punishment, and obviously that's been an evolving standard. In, you know, 1800, you'd expect a different level of health care than you'd expect today. But given the availability of health care today, there's a sort of a minimum standard of care that's expected in prisons. And there's been a lot of litigation across the country, not just in Virginia, on this issue.
But when we talk about cruel and unusual punishment, at what point does, and you talk about how it's changed from the 1800s and through today. And I know that you get this all the time. Again, some of this information, not just coming from my research into talking about incarceration, but let me thank Sandy Houseman from our local NPR WVTF rep. She did a 5-piece radio just this week. I called Brenda a month ago, and here we are at the last minute with Sandy Houseman giving me all these great questions and topics to add into our conversation. But I know you hear this, which is, I don't get health care. I'm a free citizen, and no one's giving me health care. I have to provide it, or I have to go to the emergency room and wait for hours and hours and hours. Why? I'm not, as many citizens, not understanding why someone who has committed a crime and been put into the jail system offered or supposedly provided health care that I can't get.
Well, it's not accurate that people who are outside of the prison system can't get health care. As you said, they can go to the emergency room. They can go to a free clinic. People in prison have significantly more restrictions. They can't choose to go to UVA when they feel like it. They can't choose to go to the emergency room. They can't go to the free clinic. They can only go to the doctor that the prison lets them go to, and they can only go when the prison lets them go. And beyond that, they typically have to pay for the services that they are offered, that there is some sort of copay for almost all prisoners in almost all of these settings. But once the state takes custody of people and restricts their freedom in this way, then they do have an obligation, both constitutionally and I would suggest morally, to make sure that people are not significantly worse off for being incarcerated. That is, that their lives are not put at risk and in jeopardy because they're incarcerated for some period of time.
But you must hear that frequently about... So let me step back a minute. Tell me how the system works. If I am incarcerated and I don't have the option of going to one of our local emergency rooms or free clinic when I don't feel well, what is the protocol that I need to follow to get someone from our prison system to look after me?
Well, what the prisoners have to do usually is put in a request to go to sick call. If they do that, they have to pay for the sick call visit. There, they usually meet with a nurse, and the nurse determines at that point if they are sick enough to go to the infirmary and visit with a doctor. So the prisoner doesn't really have a lot of choice. If the nurse says, you don't need to see anybody, then they don't get beyond that. And they have to pay for it. They may be, prescribed some medication or something like that, but often if it's over-the-counter, they have to pay for that through commissary. If they need Tylenol or something to that effect, they need to pay for it themselves. So there's a screening process, and they don't have a choice. If you're not in prison, you don't like the doctor or nurse that you've seen, you can go to somebody else and say, well, I need a second opinion. I don't agree with this. But in prison, they're sort of told, this is what we're going to do for you. And then there's no other choice. There's no other option. They're just given the choice that they're given.
And how does an inmate pay for, didn't you say that they have to pay?
They do have to pay. They can work jobs within the prison, but they're paid, I'm not sure exactly how much it is. Maybe Mary knows. I think it's like 40 cents an hour.
Yeah, I think that's like real typical. I talked to someone this week who said she was making between 35 and 40 cents an hour.
Right. And the sick call visit copay is $5. So, you know, that's a significant outlay for a prisoner. And it can be quite expensive, and it can be too expensive for many of the prisoners there, especially if they're sick and they can't work.
Again, our guests today, Mary Bauer and Brenda Castaneda. They're from Charlottesville's setting of the Legal Aid Justice Center. We're talking about incarceration, starting off our conversation today with the lawsuit against the Department of Corrections and the Flavanna Correctional Center for Women. Did I read properly that the Supreme Court says that overcrowding makes it impossible to provide adequate health care?
Well, the Supreme Court said that in a particular case related to the California prison system, and that was a case that went on a very long time where there were just multiple allegations of terrible treatment of prisoners with overcrowding, unhealthful conditions, and abysmal health care that put people's lives at risk. And after years and years of litigation, the court ordered that the population be decreased because there was no other way to appropriately care for that population. And the Supreme Court said in that instance that that was constitutionally acceptable, that that was an appropriate response.
All right. Let me do this.
Support today for WNRN comes from
Modlin Center for the Arts at the University of Richmond and Groovin' in the Garden, presenting two world-class banjo players, Bela Fleck and Abigail Washburn, in a rare duo performance, Wednesday, September 25th at Lewis Ginter Botanical Garden. Details available at modlin.richmond.edu or groovininthegarden.com.
You're listening to the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call, brought to you by the Markets of Tiger Fuel. You can visit Charlottesville's only locally owned and operated chain of convenience stores today. They operate on Main Street, not Wall Street. Now back to your host, Rick Moore.
And back with our guests today, Brenda Castaneda and Mary Bauer, talking about incarceration. Just before we took that break, Mary, speaking about the California system and how the Supreme Court had said that their incredible overcrowding had made it impossible to provide adequate health care. But, Brenda, my understanding is that with the Flavanna Correctional Center lawsuit, is part of that has to do with that the prisoner's request for emergency care is virtually never honored, correct?
That's right. They can put in, if they have an emergency issue, they can put in an emergency grievance and ask for care. It's often denied. If they're in distress, they can ask for help. And in many cases, the help just isn't forthcoming in a timely way.
So, again, a lot of this comes back to the same sort of strand of conversation that Mary brought up earlier, which is this is a for-profit system. This is not the state of Virginia, at least not in all cases. My understanding is that there is the Department of Corrections does provide health care in some sense and in some prisons or jails, but that this has turned into a for-profit system. Tell us a little bit more detailed information about how that works.
Well, there's a bidding system, and the companies bid to essentially get this gig from the Department of Corrections. And all across the country, this is the trend. We see for-profit companies in healthcare, and we see for-profit companies running private prisons, which is particularly disturbing, I would say. And again, the point is that that's That's just the wrong motivation in a prison setting. In a prison setting, our job as, you know, kind of societal wardens is to care for people and to ensure that they are treated humanely and that the penological, you know, purpose is served. That is, that people get out and they are, you know, the purpose is supposed to be both punishment and rehabilitation, that most people are going to get out and they're going to rejoin society.
But it's not just the health care, right? It's also, haven't they sold the food part? I mean, there's a variety of it's everything except the guards. Or is it even the guards now that have become the for-profit part of our prison system?
Well, there are private prisons. I mean, there are prisons where the entire entity is...
You mean where the state doesn't even run it? The state just determines who goes there?
Yes, that is correct. There are plenty of private prisons across the country. Now, Fluvanna is a DOC-run operation with some elements privatized.
How do you... You talked about the incentives. We need a different incentive other than... save money, you know, whatever money you save by not spending your health care dollars, you get to keep that. That is the current setup, right? If the private system of Rickmore Healthcare, I don't spend the money by helping Mary and Brenda with whatever complaints that they are making and health issues that they believe they have, I get to keep that money. That's the current setup.
That's right.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, and that's that provides a perverse incentive to provide as little treatment as possible.
Well, what's the other setup? If we have made it a privatized for-profit system, what's my other incentive to take care of you and still make money on it?
Well, I mean, and that's why we would argue that a private for-profit entity is not the way to go in a prison setting. That these really should be a different kind of incentive. That is the incentive to make sure that people are treated fairly and humanely.
And that may be the challenge for many of our fellow Americans to fall into. I've come to believe that we are a very greedy society, and I'm sorry if I've offended someone out there, but it may not be you. But unfortunately, if you swing your head left and right, it'll be many of the people that you see. Some of the statistics, and Mary, please follow up with these, but some of the ones that caught my eye, there are 2.2 million people who are currently incarcerated, 7 million people who have some criminal justice supervision, if you include parole, probation, 7 million, and 40% of the people in jail been convicted of nonviolent drug, property, or public order crimes.
That's right. And it's not because, as some people think, the crime rate in our country has, you know, escalated dramatically. In fact, the crime rate is slightly lower than it was in 1969. And yet now we incarcerate, our incarceration rate has risen by 500% in that time. So we're spending something like, states are spending around $50 billion to incarcerate people. When the crime rate is essentially kind of where it was in 1969, we're locking up five times as many people. We're doing that because we decided at some point that we wanted to lock up people who engaged in pretty low-level conduct, and we were going to lock them up for a real long time with this idea that that would discourage this kind of conduct. And the truth is, it's a monstrous failure. It is a monstrous failure in the sense that, you know, we're locking people up for really, really long periods of time at great expense for really low-level dumb stuff.
But if you read the papers and listen to the talking points that are put out, great incarceration has brought about decreased amount of crime. True? Brenda? Mary?
It's not true. I mean, the experts who've looked at this and who've really studied it, you looked at somebody like the Sentencing Project who looked at this in great depth, and they said the overwhelming reason for the decrease in the crime rate has nothing to do with the incarceration rates. That the crime rate was falling through the 90s for other reasons. And yet we continue down this incredibly expensive and harmful system of locking people up. And we don't do it in a neutral manner. I mean, I think it's really key to look at the central role that race plays in locking people up. African Americans are overwhelmingly locked up at dramatically higher rates than whites. And even though, you know, studies like the Human Rights Watch study show that they commit drug-related crimes at about the same rate as white people, but they are dramatically more likely to be stopped. They are dramatically more likely to be incarcerated for drug offenses. And, you know, right now, African-American males have about a 1 in 3 chance of serving time in their lifetime. And that's just not a neutral statistic. It's not because African-Americans are out there just being a lot worse than white folks. I mean, you look at, you know, let's be fair, how many white kids over at the University of Virginia have not committed some crime in their lifetime. We know that smoking marijuana is illegal in the state of Virginia, and yet they are not the people who are getting locked up.
11:27 here on Sunday Morning Wake Up Call. I'm Rick Moore. Our guest today, Mary Bauer, Brenda Castaneda from Charlottesville's Legal Aid and Justice Center. If you want to call in and make a point or ask a question to our guests, you're welcome to do so. It's 434-979-0919. And write that down, because next week is the Fun Drive Sunday here at WNRN. So 434-979-0919. Ladies, and Brenda, back to this, we're talking about, sort of opened with the Fluvanna Correctional Center for Women and the lawsuit that's going on there. It's profit over people. That seems to be, is that the underlying aspect of what's the lawsuit there, or is it just you're not taking care of people?
I think it is the underlying aspect, that it is profit over people. And even though this lawsuit's been going on and the state knows there's a problem and should be well aware that many prisoners are not receiving adequate care, they accepted a contract in April that was even a lower bid than what was already being spent. I believe the spokesperson for Armor, which was the prior contractor, stated that it was $17 million lower than what they had bid. So there's a new provider in there. And unfortunately, what we're seeing...
$17 million.
More of the same.
$17
right,
million.
Right. Less than they were already spending.
That's so correct.
That's for a number of different prisons, not just for Fluvanna. But, yeah, so they got a bid that's even lower than what... So they're paying even less now than what they were paying before for health care. Also with a private provider, the same perverse incentives where if you don't provide the care, then you get to keep more profit. So it's more of the same. And unfortunately, what I'm seeing reported from the women who are incarcerated is more of the same.
And this is, so to make sure I understand properly, the health care provider that was taking care of women when the lawsuit was put forth, or when the lawsuit was based on poor health care, you know, then, now there's $17 million less being spent on health care in the system?
Right. The state took bids again for the contract and went with the lowest bidder, and the bid was $17 million less than what the prior contractor was receiving.
All right, we got a phone call from Charles. Good morning, Charles.
Good morning. Here's kind of a question based on an opinion from conversation with many that work in penal institutions. But it's in relation to training the inmates as well as providing adequate health care. And so the question is there a drive to get inmates trained to work in the healthcare profession and then utilize that training through internships in the prisons to reduce costs of inmate healthcare?
Hey, that's great. I'm going to let the ladies answer that and open the phone lines. Thank you.
Well, we certainly think that the idea of providing people vocational training in prison is important and a great idea. Whether health care training is, you know, can be effectively provided in training and whether that can actually be used in a meaningful way. You know, I don't pass judgment on that because there's a fair amount of skill that's obviously involved. I mean, one of the concerns we have is that relatively lower skilled people are making the decision in Flavanna about whether someone can even see a doctor. And that's worrisome to us because many times our clients, you know that they need to see a physician and they're told no. I think looking at whether healthcare training is one of the things that should be provided in training, you know, in prison, we certainly have no objection to that.
Mary Bauer, Brenda Castaneda here from Charlottesville's Legal Aid Justice Center as we talk about incarceration in a variety of ways. Brenda, back to the Flavanna Correctional Center for Women lawsuit. Mary touched on it. You own the initial nurse, the sort of the gatekeeper for someone who thinks that they need to be seen by a doctor. Did I read properly that person, maybe not at Flavanna, but in the state of Virginia, can have as little as 1 year training as a nurse?
I'm not sure what level training they're provided. I just know at Flavanna it's a nurse that's the gatekeeper. And it is one of our allegations, though, that's inappropriate, that the prisoners aren't being adequately evaluated to determine if they need further care. And that, you know, that's sort of the end of the line for them. If the nurse says, no, you don't, go back to your building, that they're not then able to see a doctor.
All right, we have a call from Ray. Good morning, Ray.
Yes, how you doing, Rick?
I'm well. Your question or comment?
Yeah, I would just elaborate. I enjoy your show and what y'all talk about, and to make it short and quick, I know y'all are busy, but, most of the incarcerations that are done in the penal systems now is a very useless situation because it doesn't do any good to the people as a public if we feel like that they owe us something for committing the crime. But they don't get any kind of guidance or any help while they're in there. It is a true expense to us as a public. And the thing that could be beneficial to us is if they would look at ways to take these prisoners instead of incarcerating them and have them do community service for the older people that can't get up and clean their gutters, do little small things around the yard. There's so many other things we could do positive to keep us from having to have all that expense, and it's not doing any good. It's really all about politics, attorneys, and people running for office to get a big name, and they throw a lot of years on people that they don't even deserve, and it's not going to serve any purpose. And I just feel like that, you know, we as a society and as public are way ahead of that, and we all know the game they're playing, but we just keep letting it go on and happen as if it's going to change, and nothing's ever really done. So, you know, that's the only thing I'd like to comment on. I just feel like, you know, that 75% of the people that are incarcerated in that prison today are just like you and me. They've made a mistake, and they throw them in jail, and it's really not a serious offense that really is hurting anybody other than themselves. And they just need time to meet the right people and get a better outlook on life, and they would serve a hell of a lot better purpose to the whole public.
All right, Ray. Thanks, man.
All right.
Hang on a second, Mary,
yeah.
Because I see you shuffling your papers, and it was something that you touched on earlier in the hour. Get your notes, and we're going to do this real quick.
Okay.
Our members are joined by the following underwriters in their support of WNRN.
T&N Printing, serving Virginia since 1982. In addition to printing and copying, T&N specializes in construction document management, as well as dry mounting, binding, and mail services. T&N offers FSC-certified printing, an internationally recognized standard for production and consumption of forest products. T&N Printing can be reached at 434-971-8976 and t-nprinting.com.
The Jefferson Theater presenting No Scrubs 90s Dance Party with DJs Will Eastman and Brian Billion Friday, September 27th. DC DJs play Guilty Pleasures and underground classics from the 90s. Tickets for the September 27th show are at JeffersonTheater.com. No Scrubs 90s Dance Party Friday at the Jefferson Theater. Music Today. Based in Crozet, Music Today powers ticketing for local venues such as the Intellos Wireless Pavilion, the Southern Cafe and Music Hall, and the Jefferson Theater, and is official web stores for hundreds of artists, athletes, and entertainers. That's Music Today.
The Villa, Charlottesville's old-school diner at Emmett and Ivy. The Villa serves a full American breakfast all day. You can find burgers and specialty sandwiches for lunch, plus weekday lunch specials and an Italian dinner menu every night. That's The Villa, 129 Emmett Street North, and villadiner.com.
You're listening to the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call, brought to you by the Markets of Tiger Fuel. Now back to your host, Rick Moore.
And thank you for listening here to WNRN. I'm Rick Moore. This is Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call. Our guests today, Mary Bauer, Brenda Castaneda from the Legal Aid Justice Center here in Charlottesville. We're talking about incarceration. And Mary, that last caller, Ray, sort of, this is where you wanted to go in this conversation, is we can talk about specifics like the Fluvanna Correctional Center for Women, and the healthcare issue, but they are parts, they're slices of the overall pie.
Yeah, Fluvanna is a symptom of our overall craziness on this topic. The United States is the largest incarcerator of human beings in the world, both in terms of the number of people and the rate. And there's no other industrialized country that comes even close.
But that's what makes us, that's one of the things that makes us special, right? We are a world power because we identify our leaders, we identify our strong and good people, and we take the weak and hurtful people and set them aside.
Well, I think there's a growing body of evidence that this is bad for communities. This makes communities less safe in the long run. There are two things. There are the issue with who we lock up and why, and then the length of stay. That is, that we're locking people up for an incredibly long time, even for nonviolent and low-level offenses. And that's incredibly expensive just in terms of the cost of locking people up, and it's incredibly hurtful to families and communities. And there's a body of evidence that says it doesn't do what we thought it would do. When we had this kind of war on drugs, we thought this was really going to get to the root of the problem. And all the evidence says that it's not. And there's, you know, I think the good news is that there really is a large response now saying we need to look at this and we need to have a different approach. And even folks like, you know, Newt Gingrich from the right with his Right on Crime, and conservatives are saying, this is a bad use of public money. It hurts people and it's expensive.
Feel free to call us up. A great point by Ray and a good question by Charles. 434-979-0919. Talking about incarceration with Mary Bauer and Brenda Castaneda from Charlottesville's Legal Aid and Justice Center. We keep coming back to money and the amount of money being spent, but real quick, these are for-profit businesses. We've determined, or it's been told to us by the two of you, that the healthcare part, and there are even entirely private prisons or for-profit prisons. Is this sort of become circular? You know, if you make a prison or that's for profit, or even a department such as healthcare that's for profit, that you are creating a self-fulfilling entity?
Yes, it is. And those entities also have an incentive then to go lobby the government for more prisons to become privatized, or for a greater portion of the services to become privatized so that they can increase their profits. For-profit prisons often even have contracts with the state, and I think there's at least one in Virginia where the state guarantees them to maintain a certain level of capacity, like 95% capacity, regardless of the crime rates.
And we'll always send you 5,000 prisoners. I mean, that kind of thing where...
Yes, exactly. Exactly. And it's extremely troublesome, because if the crime rates go down and the contract says, regardless of the crime rates, you're going to maintain us at 95% capacity, where are those people coming from? That just means that people who wouldn't go, you know, the state then has an incentive to keep the incarceration rates up and to send people to prison who wouldn't otherwise go to prison.
All right, so back to where we were, because that just popped into my head about it seems to be a self-fulfilling issue if you're going to make it for profit. And, Brenda, thank you. I wasn't aware that there was this contract signed with the state where the state promises that 95% of your beds will be taken. But we go back to the length of time that prisoners are being put in jail. Again, back to Sandy Houseman from WVTF, who did her piece this week. Wonderful. Go read that. Go find that at WVTF. That's V as in Virginia and T as in Thomas. And she's talking about the elderly inmates. You talk about the growing number of people being put in prison. You talk about the extended length of time that they're being put in prison. And then as the boomers hit the case, now you've got all these. I think I read in one point it was 8,000, and that's probably not even accurate. I have so many numbers in my head from the homework. But the elderly that are 60 years or older who are in prison.
Well, I mean, that's right. We had, over the last several decades, a series of policy decisions that resulted in people being locked up for incredibly long periods of time. Those include things like mandatory sentencing. They include habitual offender laws like three strikes, you're out. They include these, you know, kind of truth in sentencing things that require that people serve 85% of their time, and the revocation of parole. All of those things combine to lock people up for way too long when they are, you know, even when they are elderly, when they are clearly not a danger to society, and when the crimes for which they're locked up may not be all that serious in the scheme of things. And that is incredibly expensive.
And there's also a piece that I read about that, and again, if you do choose to release them, there is a geriatric parole provision where I guess if you hit a certain age, you can ask to be put on parole specifically because of your age, and it's almost not being used, 40 of 8,000 prisoners. And again, then we come back to the issue about because you've been in jail for so long, you have no structure, you have no family, you are even less likely to find a job because of your age, you have no home to go to. And Mary, you mentioned several times now about how prisoners will be released from prison. The vast majority, 90%, is that what you said?
An overwhelming majority of people will eventually be released.
Let me touch on solitary confinement, because this was one of the issues, I think, Mary, that you sent me a link to as I do my homework. I found it interesting how the change in name, we all know it as solitary confinement, but in Virginia, it's called administrative segregation.
Virginia locks up an awful lot of people in solitary confinement for long periods of time. And they do that disproportionately with people who have broken the rules at facilities, who suffer from some sort of mental illness. And I think the overwhelming, you know, body of evidence now is that for mentally ill people in particular, solitary confinement is a form of torture. It exacerbates their pre-existing medical issues, and it is a disaster for them. And it's done not for appropriate penological purposes, but really for kind of the convenience of the facility.
When you say that for the ease for the facility, what do you mean?
Well, I mean, we have facilities that are built, a facility like Red Onion in far southwest Virginia that was built to allow large numbers of people to be locked up individually. And that's sort of the structure of the facility. And when it was built, it was said that it was going to hold the worst of the worst. But the truth is that it holds people who have broken rules, and some of them, you know, not necessarily particularly serious rules at other facilities, and they are locked up for often for very long periods of time in a way that is deleterious to their mental health. And, you know, some people locked up for years, for decades, with no human interaction.
You can, solitary confinement, I mean, all the movies say that it's for 24 hours or 48 hours or a week. You're saying for years?
For years, that this is the way that people are housed in some circumstances. And disproportionately, that is done to people who suffer from mental illness, and that is both legally and morally, you know, unjustifiable.
Is that because, so which comes first? Is it that solitary confinement leads them to be, leads them into some sort of mental illness? Or is it that the mental illness, because the issues that go along with that and sometimes the inability to follow a rule or understand a rule or whatever, leads them to be put in solitary confinement?
You see both of those things. I mean, the evidence is that prolonged solitary confinement can cause people who had not previously suffered from severe symptoms to develop severe symptoms of mental illness. But certainly people with mental illness have greater difficulty conforming with the very strict rules in a prison setting, and so may be punished for things that are clearly the manifestations of that mental illness, and punished in a way that makes them much, much more ill, and that at least one, you know, international human rights group said was torture.
Brenda, do you see any sort of this in terms of health care not given? Is part of the health care, whether it's at Fluvanna or at other facilities in the state of Virginia, is mental health care part of that?
Absolutely. It's not part of our lawsuit, but it's an issue that we've been made aware of, and it's the same issues that you see with the physical health care happen with the mental health care, the wanting to keep costs down and profits up. And I've had a number of people who've been healthcare providers at Fluvanna, or mental health care providers, contact me and say, you know, we are so glad you're doing this lawsuit, but have you looked at the mental health care? When I was there, you know, I had pressure to, you know, sort of downgrade people's mental health diagnoses so that they'd have cheaper treatment. They had, you know, a cap on the number of visits any given inmate could have with the mental health care providers, regardless of how serious their condition was. They were given a foreshortened list of medications that they were allowed to provide based largely on cost. And so it's definitely a problem.
And when you say people are contacting you, that sort of list doesn't sound like inmates who have been released. That sounds more like healthcare providers, individuals inside the healthcare system who are telling you that information.
That's right. I've heard from several people who were employed there as providers and were disturbed by what they saw and felt, you know, some of them even left because they felt they couldn't do the job they were trained to do, given the constraints on cost and the amount of care they were allowed to provide to the inmates.
I think I'm going to be ill. We're talking about incarceration with our guest today, Brenda Castaneda from the Charlottesville Legal Aid and Justice Center, her co-worker Mary Bauer. Be right back.
Today's programming on WNRN is supported by
Virginia's Motion Picture Palace, the Byrd Theater in Richmond. You're invited to a one-night-only benefit concert with Cameron Carpenter at the helm of the Mighty Wurlitzer Organ on Friday, October 4th. VIP seating with meet-and-greet, general admission, student and group tickets available at thebtf.org.
Hi, I'm Laura Hallman from Only About the Music. We are an organization that was created by music lovers to celebrate all musical genres. Strictly run by volunteers, we create a unique experience for the music lover, a chance to listen, meet, and interact with artists in an intimate setting. We invite you to our concert on November 2nd and 3rd at the Old Shebeen in Fairfax. There will be performances from David Mayfield Parade, Bobby Long, and many others. You can learn more information about us and purchase tickets at our website, onlyaboutthemusic.org. I'm Laura Hallman, making a community connection on WNRN.
Make your community connection with WNRN. Email connection@WNRN.org with your nonprofit event or organization's information. Independent Music Radio, WNRN.
And WNRN looking for volunteers to join us during the upcoming fall fun drive. Spend a few hours helping your local and fellow WNRN listeners make their donation to Independent Music Radio between September 26th and October 4th. You'll be answering the phone, entering some simple information into the computer. So please, please volunteer your time to help WNRN during this very important fall fun drive. You can contact us at volunteer@WNRN.org. All right, back with our guests, Mary Bauer and Brenda Castaneda, as we talk about incarceration. Mary, I've got a couple little questions here and there, but I can tell from your body language that you're itching to get into a topic that I haven't touched on yet.
Well, I just wanted to follow up with a point that we touched on briefly earlier, and that is the centrality of race to this discussion, because I think it's impossible to overstate that when you kind of look at who is locked up and why. From every step in the process, race plays a huge role in who gets stopped, who gets frisked, who gets arrested, who doesn't get out when they're arrested in order to help with their own trial, who gets a public defender. Every step along the way, African Americans are subjected to far worse treatment and are locked up for far longer. And that has enormous, overwhelming societal ramifications. And we just have to look at that, because these are not neutral policies. And every study that has looked at that has said, you know, that African Americans are locked up overwhelmingly more when they commit the same crimes as white folks.
Where do we start with that conversation? I mean, we can seemingly pick almost any topic in this country and provide the kaleidoscope of race onto it and have it be an issue. Because whether we talk about voter rights, whether we talk about job issues, income, healthcare, incarceration, do we pick incarceration first because of the overall unfairness? I mean, how do you do more than talk about a percentage in making this change?
Well, I mean, we should look at whether these policies serve us well as a society. And all the evidence shows that they do not, that they destroy families, they destroy communities, they, you know, overwhelmingly take away people's right to vote, to get jobs, to find housing in you know, a tremendous number of ways. Once people are incarcerated, their lives face enormous obstacles to what we consider the American dream, and often for relatively low-level conduct. And, you know, whatever our view is of this, these policies simply do not serve us well.
Well, it's recent news that the federal government has, I don't believe they've actually changed the law, but have made it known that they will be spending less time and effort and money on some of these low-level crimes, especially nonviolent drug issues. Do you think that the state of Virginia will copy this and follow along with this?
Well, I don't know whether they will. They should. I mean, Eric Holder, our attorney general, has said, you know, he's going to have U.S. attorneys really look at whether these policies serve us well, and to, you know, not ask for these kind of draconian sentences on low-level crimes, not prosecute folks for these kind of low-level drug offenses that are, you know, have basically resulted in millions of people being in the federal system, and that's great. But the majority of people who are locked up in state penal systems, and so we need to have reform at the state level as well in order to stop the destruction of families and communities.
11:55 on the wake-up call. We have a few minutes left. If you want to be a person to ask a question or make a comment. It is just about 5 minutes left in the program, talking about incarceration with Brenda Castaneda and Mary Bauer from Charlottesville's Legal Aid and Justice Center. Mary and Brenda, so back to Fluvanna. Do we know what the percentage of women there being held are fall into this category of nonviolent drug offense, property offense, et cetera?
I couldn't tell you off the top of my head what the percentage is, but I will say that in Virginia, generally, if you get a sentence of a year or less, you stay in the local jail, and if it's a year or more, then you go to the prison. So you're looking at people serving, you know, even sentences that are only 1 or 2 years ending up in the prison system.
And so as we've heard throughout the hour, someone on a, and again, I recognize that this is an issue with people on both sides of the conversation as to the length of time and how you should be punished for having marijuana in your car. But there is probably someone at the Fluvanna Women's Correctional Center who is there because they had marijuana in their car, on their body, caught some nonviolent drug offense. And the lawsuit says that they are probable to have a healthcare issue that will not be treated as should be. Is that a fair assumption, or am I taking too many steps there?
I don't know if they're probable to have a healthcare issue, but if they do have a healthcare issue, it is likely that they will not get the treatment they need. And a number of our clients are not serving long sentences. They may get out this year, next year. A number of the people we've talked to, one of our named plaintiffs is now out of prison. She finished her sentence and has been released. So I would say, yes, I mean, you're looking at people who aren't serving extremely long sentences, also receiving poor health care and coming out with worse health outcomes. And then they're, you know, out in society, they're back on the street, and you know, it's a problem for us.
One of the things I saw when doing this is that talked about hepatitis C, and I realize there's only a minute or two left, but that is an expensive disease to treat. It's very infectious in the prisons and even outside of the prisons. Virginia doesn't screen for this as some of the other states do. And then I don't know what the percentage of prisoners to get hepatitis C is, but as we've been told, it is quite infectious, and then 90% of our prison population will be released at some point.
Sure, that's just one of the illnesses that for which appropriate treatment is not provided. We know that women are disproportionately locked up for nonviolent crimes, much more so than men. They have shorter sentences overall, and they, you know, they're going to get out, and they're going to be members of our community, and their mothers. The majority of women in prison are parents, and so, you know, we have an incentive, all of us, to make sure that people are treated humanely and fairly.
Brenda, last question here. What's the next step in the lawsuit in terms of for us following it in the paper or on radio?
Well, we are sort of in the middle of it, trying to get information from the prison and from the private health care providers to support our clients' claims, and likewise, they can get information from our clients. It was set for trial in May. That's been moved. We're not sure exactly what date we'll end up with a trial, but sometime between May and September of next year, it's going to go to trial if we can't settle it before that.
All right. Ladies, thank you both so much. Brenda Castaneda, Mary Bauer from Charlottesville's Legal Aid and Justice Center.
Thanks a lot for having us.
All right. Please remember, listeners, next Sunday is the fun drive here at WNRN and support for the Wake Up Call. I hope we'll hear from you again then.
This has been your Sunday Morning Wake Up Call on WNRN. The Wake Up Call is supported by the Markets of Tiger Fuel, homegrown since 1982. You can visit Charlottesville's only locally owned and operated chain of convenience stores today. They operate on Main Street, not Wall Street.
views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of the management, staff, or board of WNRN. You can contact Rick at wakeupcall@wnrn.org. The Wake Up Call is produced by Brandon Wong. Tune in next Sunday morning at 11 for The Wake Up Call, only on WNRN.